going to take two sessions today and tomorrow to talk about the dynamics of massive change, and I've entitled this Old Age, New Age, or Old Epoch, New Epoch, Understanding Massive Change. Let me just say a few things by way of background. Here's something about what got me interested in this, and I hope is shared as interest by all of you. There are lots of folks today saying that we live at a turning point in history. John Schramm, in the Bible study on the 4th of July, even cited the Second Club of Rome report, the title of which is Mankind at the Turning Point. I will cite a few other people who say that our time is a time when something rather enormous is coming to an end and something of similar magnitude is struggling to be born. Now, we're probably the last people who are able to judge that, since even if it is true, the people who are caught in the midst of it are not the people who have the best perspective on it. But I want to pay attention, at least, to those folks who contend that we are living at a time between times, a time when some kind of age is coming to an end and some other epoch is beginning to take shape. There are lots of people who doubt that. We can debate that, but I want to cite some of the contenders of that, and we'll see where it turns out. That's one item by way of background. Another item by way of background, this pertains to my own interest in this, was a remark by George Lindbeck, who teaches church history at Yale, who as a historian said that we spend a lot of our time comparing ages in which change is prevalent with the age that is a more settled one before it. We spend our time comparing discontinuity and continuity. We spend our time looking at how one age, which is more turbulent, is different from a preceding time which was more settled. And he said, that probably doesn't tell you much about the nature of change. What you ought to do is take those epochs in history which we think of as epochs of as turning points, the 1st century, 4th century, the 16th century and the Reformation, many would say the 20th century, and compare them with one another to see if there are common characteristics of massive change, rather than comparing them with times when there wasn't prevalent change. So I was just intrigued with that remark. If you start comparing ages, which in the past have been times of massive change, are there common patterns to that change? Another background remark. I read a book, which some of you know, by Thomas Kuhn called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And he says that the great changes that come about in science are changes that come about not by so much experimentation in the sense of following through nitty-gritty detail on some hypothesis, but by great leaps of imagination, where a person stood and looked at all that data that had been there a long time. It didn't make sense anymore the way it had been explained scientifically before, and then reconceived it, saw it in a new light, saw it differently. And Kuhn said that there are patterns that can be discerned in scientific revolutions. Some other people said Kuhn's characteristic patterns about how the great changes in science took place are in fact patterns which can be perceived in when people change their mind in a massive way about anything. that there are patterns in changes of people's perception and how people understand things. So I thought, let's see if that can be applied to history. Well, that's one thing we'll come across here. Another item, again, by way of background, my own interest in this. The New Testament constantly talks in terms of old age, new age, or old humanity, new humanity, or creation, new creation, or leaving father and mother behind. The language in the New Testament just struck me as language which is the same kind of talk that one hears when you look at times in history experiencing massive change. When revolutionaries talk, they talk about the creation of a new humanity, or they talk about leaving the old Russia behind and creating a new Russia. It's the same kind of talk. So I thought, let's take a look at characteristics of massive change, then take a look at the New Testament materials and see if any of that New Testament language is illumined by this kind of sociology of change. I think there are some striking things there, and we want to talk about that over the next two periods. I've chosen to do this in two periods because I think that will leave time each of today and tomorrow for discussion. I want to focus on change of perception. By that I simply mean change in how we see things, change in how we look at the world. There are other kinds of change that are very important, and all of these kinds of change get interlocked with one another, but I want to focus on change of mind, change of worldview. And I want to use as a starting point, at least, the calls for change by the people who spend a lot of time these days worrying about two gaps, the gap between rich and poor and the gap between the well-being of the human family and the well-being of the environment. We call it the gap between humanity and nature, the worry about whether we're overtaxing the Earth's resources for the sake of our own short-term, but not long-term, well-being. It is these folks who, interestingly enough, often scientists and engineers and systems analysts, and are calling for change of mind. It might be helpful at the outset to distinguish three different kinds of change that are presently being called for. The first is technological change. Lots of folks say that we're living in an industrial society that is chewing up at a historically furious rate the non-renewable resources that fire our society. So they also say we owe our life to science and technology to an extraordinary degree, and that we cannot sustain our society without ongoing scientific and technological innovation. So there is a call for ongoing technological change. That should be quite obvious. It's certainly a common state of affairs, even with the disillusionment these days about technology. There, both critics and advocates alike call for ongoing technological change. We also hear calls for a second kind of change these days, which you might call changes in the way in which we organize ourselves, changes in the way in which we put human society together. Some people call that structural change, or changes in the systems by which we put and hold things together. The third kind of change is the one that I want to focus on, change of perspective or perception change. And I just, again, mean by that a change in the way in which we see understand, value things. A lot of different language is used to get at this change. Some people say we have to have some change in some basic assumptions we hold about ourselves, about our relationship to nature, and so on. Others say we need a new definition of the good life. That's change of perception in my definition. Others say change in core values. Others say our beliefs. All of this has to do with change of and how we see things. What's intriguing is this call for something more than technological change, or even a call for something that is more, that goes deeper than changes of how we organize ourselves, but this call for change in the inner world of society and culture, and not only changes in the vast outer apparatus, as important as that is. Okay, now let me just cite a few people who, some of them say that such change is taking place, change in our basic values, understandings, attitudes, outlooks. Others say it isn't, and they wish it would, so they call for that kind of change. I want to cite first Willis Harmon of the Stanford Research Institute, who says, first of all, that systemic change, change in how we organize ourselves, is already well underway, and he says, I think it's much exaggerated, but just to give you some idea of what is being claimed in some quarters, quote, systemic change is underway that is comparable in importance to such transitions as the prehistoric change from a hunting and gathering to an agricultural society or the Industrial Revolution, end of quote. And then he goes on to say that this systemic change, however, is part of an even more basic transformation that, quote, involves a metamorphosis in basic cultural premises, a change of fundamental value premises, the root image of man and society, and all aspects of social roles and institutions, end of quote. Oh, that's a lot. I mean, that's a change. That's a lot of change. When the walrus in Wonderland thought the time had come to talk of shoes and ships and sealing wax, cabbages and kings, the walrus didn't have a list that was as long as Harmon's list of things that we need to talk about, if that's the kind of change that we're talking about. Harmon is deeply convinced, another quotation, that the industrialized world is simultaneously undergoing a conceptual revolution as thoroughgoing in its effects as the Copernican Revolution, and an institutional revolution as profound as the Industrial Revolution. Copernican Revolution referring to the fact that we thought we sat at the center of the universe and found out that the Earth was not the center of the universe, so we had to reconceive our place in the universe, and then the Industrial Revolution referring to that massive change in society. Well, he thinks that we're right in the middle of change of that magnitude. Other people are more reserved about the kind of and degree of change, but some of them are just as insistent that it occur. They're worried that it isn't occurring on the degree that it must. Mankind at the Turning Point puts it this way, after concluding a look at our present world and scenarios of possible scenarios of the future, they said, quote, drastic changes in the norm stratum, awkward phrase, that is, in the value system and the goals of man, are necessary to solve our energy, food, and other crises. Or Carol and John Steinhardt in a book, The Fires of Culture, which is a book about energy, say in the beginning, our global energy problems, lack of food, supply of waste energy, uncertainty about future energy supply are the result of human actions We need more energy, we are told, so that progress can continue, but can more of the behavior that caused the problem solve them? The best that energy technology can do is make things tidier while we struggle to change our habits. And we must change not only our habits, but some of our most fundamental assumptions and beliefs. Ian Barber, in a book called a collection of essays along the same lines, only a major change in attitudes and values and a new definition of the good life can permanently alter the burden we place on global resources. Or Rufus Miles Jr., in a book called Reawakening from the American Dream, concludes that we Americans, quote, are at the most important crossroads in our 200-year history, one in fact faced by all Western civilization, and that what we need is a changed set of values and a new set of direction. The compass we have been following has gone awry. Well, these are folks that are calling for massive change of perception and are worried that we're not in the midst of it. And ought to be. I have found it intriguing that the call for a massive change of values and meanings has been coming from lots of quarters that have not been, you might say, very musical in religion. The scientists, the engineers, have not been the people that have generally called for change at this level. The industrialists have been policymakers, have been the ones that have been tolling the bells here. And what is intriguing is the place that religion plays in the call for change of perspective. In some sense, that's not a surprise, because religion revolves around what people regard as their most far-reaching loyalties, their deepest commitments, their deepest conviction. Religion has to do with what are people's most cherished dreams and visions. And that is what these people are saying is the level at which the change is either taking place or needs to take place. So Jürgen Randers, who is a systems analyst, was one of the team at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology that worked on the first report of the Club of Rome entitled Limits to Growth. After he did all of that, he said, quote, probably only religion has the moral force to bring about the necessary change. I didn't start with that. And he's not particularly concerned about the practice of religion. Incidentally, he went on after that to do a doctoral dissertation on how changes of values occur in society because of his conviction that that was the level at which a change needed to take place. Or Robert Heilbrunner, in the end of the book, Inquiry into the Human Prospect, rather reluctantly comes to cast his lot with religion, since the changes required must occur on, as he says, on the level of people's basic guiding images and their most basic beliefs. At the end of the book, Heilbrunner himself doesn't come out of practice of one of the religious faith. He's not an observing, as they say, an observing Jew. At the end of the book, he says, we have been guided by the image of Prometheus as driving and creative spirit. And now we need a different image to guide us into the future. And then he proposes one, Atlas, who bears the burdens of the world on his shoulders. I'm not fond of that one, but it's interesting that he comes to the point where he's kind of, again, reluctantly casts his lot with religion. Even Herman Kahn, who is easily the most optimistic about obtaining and maintaining a high level of affluence for a long-term future, credits religion with a decisive role in what he regards as a crucial transition period in getting from where we are now to a different place. He has a project called the Prospects for Mankind Project, and in a symposium that launched the first book in that project, he says, something like a religious revival is key to the whole enterprise in getting from here to there. These people no doubt would mean different things when it comes to the content of religion, but I find it interesting that they are saying that the global issues that we face now go so very deep, that is, in their implications, that they require change at the level of basic outlook and understanding, values and assumptions. And that these folks are calling for, if not saying that we're in the midst of, calling for what you might call a cultural conversion, a transformation that has a religious dimension. Now, don't understand religion as having only to do with the organized religions of the world, even Christianity or Judaism in our case, but religion as simply referring to the human phenomenon of that which is of ultimate concern to you, that which goes deepest around your loyalties, loves, convictions, commitments. Okay. I think in our discussion, one thing we can ask is whether in fact such change is going on. Number two, whether it's necessary, as some of these people say. And then part of the third question is related to that. Is it called for, and what would the nature of that change be? But before that, let's ask the question, what are the dynamics of such transformation or of cultural conversion? There's a text that I want to cite in the 12th chapter of Romans, and this is part of seeing some things in the New Testament that I think are intriguing, looked at in light of the cultural change. The second verse of the 12th chapter of Romans goes like this, Paul writing, adapt yourselves no longer to the pattern of this present world, but let your minds be remade and your whole nature thus transformed. Then you will be able to discern the will of God and to know what is good, acceptable, and perfect. Now, let's assume that, for the sake of consideration and discussion, that we do live in a time when something enormous is passing away and something is coming to be, that some kind of change of massive character is going on, that we live in a time that's a turning point or a transition, a time between more settled times. Let's also, again, for the sake of entertaining some discussion and questions, assume that the New Testament was a time between times. So that when Jesus says, let those who have ears to hear, let them hear, he means those that can attune themselves to a new reality, let them heed its coming. Something significant is coming to pass that you may see, or you may not be able to see it. It depends upon a conversion, depends upon a change in your ability to discern. There are lots of places in the New Testament where you get this picture of two ages living on occurring on the same turf. The fifth chapter of James, for example. Next, a word to you who have great possessions. Weep and wail over the miserable fate descending on you. You have piled up wealth in an age that is near its close. But alas, or from Luke, for you who are rich, you have had your time of happiness. Alas, for you who are well fed now, you shall go hungry. Alas for you who laugh now, you shall mourn and weep. An age is coming to an end. Something else is coming about. Paul's exhortation is, adapt yourselves no longer to the pattern of this present age. You might translate that equally well by saying, cease being conformed, as is some, in some translations, to this current age. All right. In a time when epochs sort of meet at the same intersection, transformation centers on a basic recasting of how we see things. So Paul says, let your minds be remade, and then your whole nature be transformed. It's a cause-effect kind of thing. Now, the Greek word for mind is nous. You mustn't think of mind simply in terms of thinking. At least, you mustn't think of this word for mind in those terms. The Greek word for mind, nous, refers to the self, the whole person, in its comprehending and judging of the world, in how it sees the world and the sense that it makes of it. Isn't to the intellect as a separate faculty, but to the whole self as it knows its world. So the line of change then can be described in this way. The remaking of mind, the changing of mind, results in seeing things in a very different way than you saw them before. You're looking at the same world, but now you understand it quite differently. There's a new grammar or a new logic, a new pattern to things. The previous experiences that you had, the previous data that you looked at are still there, but they appear in a different light. You look even at the experiences of your own life, you look back at them, and with remade mind, they add up to something different. You get some insight into them that hadn't occurred to you before. Or events are cast in a new light. They're reordered. Or neglected experiences, or experiences that didn't make sense, that didn't fit, or events that didn't fit, somehow now fall into place. There's a kind of, often a kind of simplification of things where major segments of things have new relationships, and people's sense is one of insight and illumination. Jesus' word for that and Paul's word for that event is metanoia, which is usually translated as repentance. Metanoia to the kingdom of is at hand. Repent, the kingdom is at hand. Notice that in the word metanoia, listen to it, you hear that root word nous, noia, nous. So that repentance, viewed in this light, refers to a basic reorientation affected by a change or a correction of mind. You look at the world differently, you see it differently, and as a consequence, your whole nature, your way, who you are and your way of life changes. A basic reorientation of mind, a transformation of the way in which you see things. And then your character is altered. When mind is renewed, then one's whole being, is the way Paul says it in some translations, one's whole being is affected. So he says, let your minds be remade, and then your whole being will be transformed. The Greek word for transformation there is metamorphouste. A metamorphosis occurs that affects the whole self. One is a different person with a different outlook. That's the result of repentance, change of mind. And in this verse, the consequence is that discernment is affected. Then, Paul says, you will be able to discern the will of God, what is good, acceptable, and perfect. Seeing things differently means seeing some things that you didn't see before, or comprehending things you didn't comprehend before, or judging things differently from the way you judged them before. Some things that didn't make sense inside the old perspective now make sense inside a different perspective. And things that did make sense inside the old perspective are now just the occasion for sort of smiling and shaking one's head. You say, how could I have seen things that way? You just sort of shake your head and kind of smile at yourself. What was once inconceivable now seems possible, and what was once made all sorts of sense now doesn't make any sense at all for you anymore. That's the transformation of mind. The dynamics of that, you have to go to other places in Paul. When you're living in a time of overlapping and some maybe conflicting ages, then the dynamics of repentance, of metanoia, of remaking of mind hold. Paul says in another case, place, we will never know for certain or see with full clarity, full discernment, but always through a glass darkly until the new age arrives in its fullness. Until then, Paul says, knowing participates in the dynamics of cross and resurrection, of dying and rising. One's whole being is subjected to convulsive and wrenching renewal, and it's an ongoing renewal so long as the ages overlap with one another. One is constantly in the process of having one's mind being remade, and it's painful. Living at the junctures of ages is not a comfortable place to reside. There will be some breaks, and again, I don't know what the New Testament scholars will think of this, because I'm coming at the New Testament materials with this sociology of change in mind rather than asking what the texts meant in their situation. But the New Testament seems to me suggests that there will be breaks. Some of them will be very sharp. Jesus' call to leave father and mother, brother and sister, is a rather accurate indicator of what in fact occurs in times that are times between times. That isn't his campaign to sort of extinguish all good family relationships. It's a statement that renewed minds undergoing transformation often mean that fundamentally different and sometimes conflicting views carry with them different ways of living, so that some past values, even those most carefully nurtured by loving parents at their children's bedsides, belong to a different universe. At turning points, many friends become former friends. Many earlier friends have gone a different way than you or I. They become former friends, not for reasons of some precipitated anger, but simply because now you or they see life and live it differently than when you inhabited the same universe of perception and understanding. So metanoia occurs, transformation takes place. Or Jesus' word, it was a vesper last night and the text for this week, I'll give it a different slant here. Jesus' word, my burden is light, my yoke is easy, I think is an insight into the dynamics of transformation. If life is in fact perceived and recast in a different way, markedly different way, then a burden and a yoke are inevitable. That is to say, hardship and struggle come with the breaks that are entailed in living by a different view of things than you used to. Yet, because they belong part and parcel to the logic of a vision that you now assent to with your whole being, those burdens and those yokes and that struggle is light. So struggle is joined, even joyfully. You join Jesus in that new way. It's struggle, it's hard, it's pain, but because you ascend to it with your whole being, it's the way in which your mind has now been recast, it becomes a burden and a yoke that are light and easy. It's natural inside now this new sense of reality to take up the cross. Natural not being confused with painless, of course. Okay, one further remark about the dynamics of transformation out of this verse. Being transformed, that's Paul's language, doesn't play out on a single line that runs from my single self to God. Paul's language is all plural. The earlier verse is, therefore, my brothers, I implore you by the mercies of God to offer your very selves, plural. Let your minds be remade, plural. Then you, plural, will be able to discern. Transformation occurs in community. It occurs with others. And here, in Paul's description here, it's the church. And it's in the church, actually. And again, not the church as separate bodies, but as the single body of Christ. And the next six verses are verses of in ethics about what is appropriate to the church now having been transformed. So the transformation occurs in community. Okay. I want to make sure that we have some... Well, what is the time that you have?
It's about 7 after.
7 after 10?
10.
Ah!
10 after.
That's late. The hour is late. I wanted to get started since I announced that we were going to talk about the characteristics of change. But before trying to talk about the most salient features of cultural conversion, let's just pause here and see if people have any remarks to what's been said so far. Again, those questions, do we in fact live in such a time, whatever the claims are, or do we need basic changes in outlooks, values, perceptions? And then this last item, do the biblical materials shed any light on that? Paul?
I want to ask you a question, Larry. It's kind of a fundamental question. Why do you associate the kinds of changes in attitude that you've mentioned? You singled out changes in attitudes toward worldwide wealth and poverty,
yeah,
and toward the environment.
Yeah.
Why do you associate those changes in attitudes with the kind of, with metanoia?
Yeah.
Now let me explain. It seems to me quite possible, very easy, to read these changes in attitudes as involving no real metanoia at all, but simply a continuing pursuit or search for means toward the attainment of a comfortable life.
Yeah.
You see, if my real interest is in a comfortable life, and now I decide, we're screwing up the environment,
mm-hmm,
or the nation's getting kind of powerful, where the balance of power,
mm-hmm,
is shifting,
mm-hmm,
and then I say, so I better start living differently, and maybe,
yeah,
even ought to change my attitudes.
Yeah.
I would have trouble really identifying that with a kind of radical new age, old age that the New Testament,
yeah,
seems.
Yeah, yeah. I understand the question. I took up that question of the New Testament materials because some of the people who were concerned about rich poor and the use of resources, et cetera, seemed to me to be calling for radical change. Now, whether it's that radical is one of the questions, but some of those people I was citing only change at the base, of our basic loyalties, self-understandings, attitudes, and values. can affect the kind of change that is necessary. Some of the people I cited were calling for that kind of change. It's another whole question of whether that kind of change is in fact necessary. I mean, one can say that we can rely upon some enlightened self-interest. I mean, it's just foolish of me to, if I'm in the Japanese whaling industry, to, you know, kill off all the whales. So I'll have to do something that makes sure that they are there for a while. Or it's just foolish not to avoid all sorts of political problems by not acceding to some of the demands of an alliance of the poor countries. I mean, I think one could argue about going that way, but in answer to your question of why I went to look at metanoia, it's because I think some of the people are calling for change that goes that deep. And that was the reference to only religion has the moral force to bring about such change.
Can I just
follow
that up? But when these guys say, when Kyle Brunner, the first fellow you mentioned, say that only religion can do the job, they're now using religion as a means to an end.
Right.
And that's significant.
Exactly. In fact, one of my basic criticisms of Heilbronner is at that point, religion is valuable for its pragmatic results. And the whole truth question of what in fact is true and the religion's claim to that is not confronted. That's the difference between that and the New Testament. Religion in this case is a vehicle for getting from here to there in their judgment. It's a very utilitarian notion of religion. I have real problems with that. But I nevertheless think it's very significant that such people who you wouldn't think would be inclined to go to sources even such as religion are in fact attracted to that almost out of desperation. I mean, it comes out of their reading of the situation. So that it isn't enough to ask what institutional changes. When they probe what institutional changes are necessary, they end up saying, we won't get those institutional changes until people's outlooks themselves are altered. And, you know, that's a place for argument, but that's, I think, the direction. And thus, I think he has some real contact points with what are you up to when you're talking about cultural conversion or transformation of the society. And that's the source of my curiosity about metanoia. There may be something quite more radical in metanoia than that.
Seems to me you could turn that utilitarian use of religion around on those people and recognize in what they're doing a kind of tipping of the hat to the centrality and the essentiality of religion in a life and in a culture. In other words, they may think to be and may seem to be using religion in a utilitarian way, but they may be saying more than they know.
Mm.
They may be implying more and saying certainly much more about religion and its function and the way it works in people and in communities toward change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes?
In my perception of religion, or especially churches, organized religion, is that they aren't necessarily the leaders of moral change.
No.
They come along behind.
Yeah.
After a change is already beginning to take place, they kind of drag along.
Yeah.
There's a lot of conservatives holding back, you might say, in our organized institution and real religion.
Yeah, that's very often been the case.
I think some of these changes, if you're talking about the environmental ones and the rich poor, are political and motivated and economically motivated. And that has sort of been the force that has that has sort of made things happen most recently.
Mm-hmm.
The church has always had to stand.
Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Why is it happening today as yeah. opposed to 100 years ago?
Yeah. Again, I want to make a clear distinction between forms of organized religion that we're accustomed to, the churches, and religion as it's being talked about here, which is a synonym for whatever it is that is of most value and concern to a person, our most cherished convictions and concerns, that which matters most. And that underlies political, or is a part of political and economic life as well.
As far as the depth of the radical change
yeah.
we're talking about, in this country at least, we're talking about a change from the Enlightenment theory, that our whole country is based on. A complete change from that. The whole idea of consumer-oriented culture with success being measured
mm-hmm.
by possession of things and everything,
mm-hmm.
that has to change
mm-hmm.
if we're really going to make the kind of change it's talking
mm-hmm.
about. So it is a radical change. It's
mm-hmm.
not just a slight turning of direction,
mm-hmm.
As I see it.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people say that. I think it's a good subject for a debate, but a lot of people say that enlightenment man, this picture of which centers on the individual's rights in society, is, especially as it goes through Anglo-Saxon life, society exists for the purpose of guaranteeing individual rights and maximizing individual choices. The picture of humanity as essentially apart from and above nature, and which resources are there for human use and do not have rights of their own. A lot of people saying that Enlightenment man picture is one that needs to be changed, and that it has been, formative of our society. Paul?
I just thought of what I think is a good metaphor.
Uh-huh.
It helps me. I'm puzzled by what radical change
uh-huh.
really means. It's easy to suppose that radical change isn't it. But I have a friend who in his early 30s had a heart attack, and he suffered. He in his life has undergone radical change. And you could call it a change in attitudes, thing of things that he used to not value, he now values.
Uh-huh.
But on the other hand, is that really right? I mean, I'm not going to answer, but if you think about that, he has a different attitude toward religion, toward running, toward eating, toward other people, everything. Now, isn't
yeah.
it, or is that just a continuation of the old age
well,
under new circumstances?
Yeah, that's what I want to talk about tomorrow, is what I just want to share some kind of tenets about the character of radical change, and part of that is relationship of old and new, continuity, discontinuity, and then we'll see what happens there and whether it is or not. I mean, I don't know. I just want to offer those as something to talk about.
I'm curious as to what are the signs of radical change taking place. What are the evidence to this point that lead us to believe that maybe it's popular to say yes, there is radical
yeah.
change, because who can disprove that really at this point? And if a person says that, maybe they show they have a little more vision and they see all the radical change, so it's maybe popular to say that.
Part of the signs may be the testimony of someone like Paul's friend. You hear the testimony of lots of people who, when they look back upon their own lives, say that they're in a very different place, and then exhibit that in the way in which they live, that their previous understandings are no longer their present understanding. Previous values are no longer their present values. Even their lifestyle is no longer their present lifestyle, and then that gets that may be that's part of the testimony for some pretty basic change. There are a lot of people in American studies who say that this country underwent some pretty basic change after World War II, not only in its place in the world, but the kind of society that has come about since then. And they refer to such, they look at charts and they say per capita energy use is twice in 1976 what it was in 1953, and look at production and consumption and see big changes, and that's what's referred to as indicators of that. I'm not sure what Harmon, the first one I said, who says, you know, things are changing in a way that's as dramatic as from agricultural to society to industrial society, and Copernican revolution in our outlooks. I'm not sure what all the testimony or evidence is there. I trust he feels he has some, but I can't tell you just what that is.
Sociologists say that a time of change starts with a breakdown of social institutions and then goes on into a rebuilding of new social institutions.
Yeah.
There's some evidence of breakdown, certainly, in our times of social institutions, but I see that kind of change more as something we need to do rather than something that is that's happening.
Yeah. Some people would say that, you know, viewed in historical perspective, give us a few decades, the place of the family in American life has undergone what needs to be called dramatic at least, change.
Well, and our feelings about political institutions too are not in such sharp shape at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the radical change doesn't come until it really affects us on a one-to-one level, the way when if the doctor saw the hermit kept coming and said, you need to follow the following program in order to guard your health, and his friend may or may not have changed.
Yeah.
But once the heart attack comes, then you change. I wonder if maybe that isn't the premise when, because Americans give more now, money
and
for world aid.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's not true.
We've been incredibly well, and we support missions, and we'll do wonderful things for sending boxes of things and cash to feed equal people. And if they'll turn right around and build a church for $1 million that only they will use, and they won't want to put, say, a disadvantaged preschool in it because the kids will run all over the carpet. You
know,
where
does it change? Where is the point that we're willing to?
I'm confused about that.
Yeah. I think it's pretty safe to say that basic, pretty fundamental change is a combination of two things. One, pressures, many of which you would never have elected yourselves, and vision, that is to say, something that attracts you to something else. If you just have pressures without the vision, then there's enormous resistance to the change, and it doesn't go deep, it doesn't go to changes of values and attitudes without the vision. If you just have the vision without the pressures, very few people get in on it because it's only a voluntary. Case change would be related to what's called awareness or change of consciousness or some sort of discernment of something is a problem.
When it actually, when it when you actually have buildings for yourself.
Yeah. Okay, we must be in the coffee break, so people feel free to move as they wish.